tonight on Arena. Alwyn Ferry on her new film, The Reckoning of Erin Morrigan. And we have live music from singer and multi-instrumentalist Áine Tyrrell. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Themes of loyalty, conscience and the past permeate the feature film The Reckoning of Erin Morrigan, which will debut at the Galway Film Fla on Thursday the 10th of July. Alwyn Ferry plays Erin, former IRA operative living a marginal existence in a safe house in rural Donegal. The character is dying of cancer, haunted by the past, and unexpectedly a young man shows up on her doorstep on the run from a devastating and violent action of his own. Delighted that Alwyn Ferry is sitting across the desk from me in studio this evening. And when I saw that title, Alwyn, The Reckoning of Erin Morrigan, I thought, OK, right, we're going to have some kind of mythological tale here. And even as the film started, we're in this bleak Donegal landscape. It could be any period, any time in history almost, and your character is there. And then I've very quickly realised, no, this is a very contemporary story mm-hmm. about the Northern Irish Troubles. It's quite a mix to put those two things together.
It is. I mean, but that is kind of where Gabrielle started. She's actually working on...
This is Gabrielle Russell, the writer and director. Yeah.
She's actually writing, she's working on a trilogy of films based on a mythological, a female deity, mythological deity. And so she had the idea of the Morrigan. And then her first image for the film was actually a woman lying in her grave, still alive. And then the story of Erin Morrigan just started coming together around that. She then realized that woman was Irish and was a Republican fighter. And then she started to research lots of Republican women. Mm. And all this story built up around her script, basically.
Yeah, because I suppose the story of Erin is in many ways a conglomeration of many stories that we might be slightly familiar with. She certainly is carrying quite a lot of... I don't know what the word... How to describe what she's carrying from the past? Mm-hmm. How do you describe what the character is carrying?
Well, I think she is carrying a memory and... a reckoning, as in the title, but it's. I was very concerned, and it's something that I discussed at depth with Gabrielle that there should not be any kind of sense of guilt or a sense of repentance, that she is deeply committed to her cause, and that should continue through the film. So, I don't know if we succeeded in that, but that was very much my concern, that there was no, you know, that there was the remorselessness of a convicted, of a committed political activist, essentially. And I felt that was important. So I think as with any cause that you fight for, there are things you have to do or situations that you have to get through, which will not be easy. And in her case, it's the killing of the man she loves, who was an informer.
Yeah, and the whole idea of the informer and all of that side of things is very clear in it. And as you say, there's no sense of repentance or regret. She's haunted by what she had to do. But if it happened again, I think she would do exactly the same thing again.
Yeah, and that's the kind of lesson she gives the boy as well.
You know? Is the young boy who comes to
her.
Yeah,
the young boy who comes. That's the lesson she gives him, because he claims that he accidentally shot a young woman. And she just says to him, you know, that was a mistake and you have to live with them and you have to carry on. There are mistakes. And also she is very clear that, you know, once you take on this road, this conviction, this belief, you have to live with what you have to do. You have to live with the consequences and not and not regret them or feel guilt about them and move on forward. That's the only way through.
Yeah, she keeps telling him, if you're a soldier,
you
have to be able to do these things. That's the price, and
that's
what the calling,
if that's the right word to use,
that you just have to be like that. Let's have a listen. She's trying to strike a deal with him, however. Mm-hmm. She wants to strike a deal with him because she is dying of cancer and very unwell, and clearly no medicine is going to do much good for her in the state that she is. So here she is having a chat with Jake. Is Jake or Jack Doyle?
Jake Doyle,
who plays the young boy in the piece. Is he named as Aaron at one point, or did I pick that?
No, that may be a reference
to your name.
It must have been a reference to your name. The boy.
The character, just referred to as the boy. So he doesn't say very much. I think he might say one little bit at the end of this clip. It's mostly you kind of trying to strike the deal with him.
You think if you lie low for a while, this'll all go away? Listen. You're a soldier. The first rule of a soldier, you're never safe. Do you hear me? And when they come for you,
and they will, you'll say, I was only following orders. And they'll say,
whose orders? What'll you say then? Never talk. If you talk, you're dead. If the enemy doesn't get you, your own will. Do you understand what I'm saying? Get up. Stand up straight.
Look at me.
You can stay. So long as you help me. I need a hand. You'll do. Deal?
Deal? Good.
That's Alwyn Fuere as Aaron Morrigan in the film The Reckoning of Aaron Morrigan. And Alwyn is with me in studio this evening. As I said to you at the top of our chat, Alwyn, you can hear how contemporary the piece is there. I mean, it's a post-Troubles situation, and all of those, you know, the idea of the informer, the idea of standing over what you had to do, all of that is present in this. How does that fit in with the deity or the mythological creature that is, or the character that is, the Morrigan? Maybe tell us a little bit about her and how you think it feeds into this story.
Well, the Morrigan is primarily known for, is associated primarily with war, fate, sovereignty. And she's a shapeshifter, which you don't really see in the film, except that the crow, the raven, has a presence in the film, which is the Morrigan's main manifestation will be as the raven, as we know. The raven on Cuchulainn's shoulder, on the statue in the GPO, and she's also a kind of a death bringer, but not just a death bringer, a somebody who will help you to transition into the other world, who will bring your transition into the other world. So she's not just like a monstrous, totally monstrous kind of mythological character. She's got this magical ability to travel between worlds, and I think that, and she is obviously very strongly associated with the land, all of those things. So I think it's in that way of being the warrior, following your fate, which is to be a fighter for what you believe in, and the death bringer. She brings death to people, but she is also taking care of her own death in a way that she feels is appropriate.
She has an extraordinary line, which is lots mm-hmm. of extraordinary, but one in particular that stood out to me: we can choose our path, mm-hmm. but not where it takes us.
Yeah.
Which is that, well, you choose to do this, but you have to accept. You don't know what the consequences
are. You
don't
know necessarily where it's going to go, you know. And she would probably have never imagined that she would have to kill the man she loved.
Yeah, and that's part of what she's dealing with there. I wondered to what extent, I mean, I know you've spoken numerous times in the past about your father and his own activism in terms of Breton separatism, and that was what brought your family to Ireland. He essentially was a political exile at that time. When you're treating a subject like this, which is politically, it's certainly in the same region, same area, Does that family experience inform or help you in any way?
Oh, well, it's huge. I mean, I felt a massive political responsibility doing this film. I mean, for a whole load of reasons. But definitely that would be one of them, of knowing how, you know, what the consequences of choosing a life like that are. And I mean, my father had no regrets, but I think it was a tough life for his loved ones, not me specifically, but for my mother. It was a very tough life, I think, the choices that he made. And even when she asked him to marry her, he said, yes, I'll marry you as long as you don't reproach me for putting Brittany first.
So he was very clear what was top of his agenda. And it was political activism on his part rather than any kind of armed struggle, though, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't get involved in armed struggle, although there are various associations, you know, I mean, people do say that he was involved with the FLB, which was not exactly an armed struggle, but, you know, they were responsible for some explosions and, you know, some bombings.
You said that you felt a particular political responsibility taking on this film.
Yeah.
Was that its immediacy to the very recent Northern Irish troubles? And how did you go about assuaging those particular anxieties?
Well, I mean, when Gabrielle first approached me, I said, look, I'm really, really interested in doing this. It's definitely up my street. But I was conscious that, you know, it was a British perspective, no matter how well researched.
Yeah, Gabrielle
is British. And there was, you know, the risks of it being a British perspective, even in the language that was being used. But we had a lot of discussion about all of that, and she's fantastic to collaborate with. You know, she was really great to collaborate with. But I did ask her, did she mind if I sent a copy of the script to my friend Lawrence McKeown, just to kind of get his perspective on it?
One of the hunger strikers.
Yeah, who's one of the hunger strikers, and who's, you know, involved in film in lots of ways. He's one of the founders of the Belfast Film Festival, and he was great in his response. You know, he just gave us a few little, you know, he gave us feedback and a few comments, you know, which helped to tweak some certain things.
It did strike me too that, I mean, it's I know there were several shooting locations, but in my head it was all in Donegal.
Yeah.
You know, which is the magic of film, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need to know that some of the interiors were shot somewhere else in some ways. I wondered, you know, that must have brought you back to your childhood in the west of Ireland and growing up in the west of Ireland. I mean, it's a very similar landscape. But that idea of the border is interesting, and certainly in terms of the Morrigan character as well, if you think of this thing of crossing over from one side to another.
Yeah, very much so. And actually, Malinhead, which is where we filmed a lot of it, is one of the most ancient landscapes I've ever stood on. It feels incredibly ancient. And in fact, when I was reading Manca Magan's book about I think it was not 32 Words for Feel, the other one, Listen to the Land Speak, he talks about Malinhead, and he says it is still sinking since the Ice Age. It is still moving down. I thought that was absolutely fascinating, but you feel that. You feel that it's just this incredibly powerful ancient landscape. So it was, it was a very interesting choice of location.
Yeah, and also where Aaron Morrigan is living, there are ruins of old houses nearby, and you can almost hear the history speaking to you through those old ruins.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it was a very powerful location, I felt. So did a lot of the shooting around there, and then the other indoor sections were shot in the Northern Film School in Leeds.
There you go. Well, at least it was in the north of somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
I also was very struck, and I didn't know this when I was watching the film. I looked at your fabulous mane of white hair, and I was checking with you before we came to air tonight. Lucky in Waiting for Godot, is it actually described that Lucky should have this mane of white hair that falls down when the hat is taken off? And it is. And it struck me watching today, I wonder where it would make a great Lucky in Waiting for Godot. And lo and behold.
Yeah, amazing that you didn't. Yeah.
Like, I knew nothing about what had happened last autumn, was it?
No, it was
more
April.
Recently.
It was April. It was Sean Doran's, one of Sean Doran's festivals, which is the Oh My God, Oh Festival, which he's actually based that festival around the kind of Good Friday Agreement anniversaries. And so he had this idea of like casting north and south, or east and west. And so there were two English actors, and it was a reading, but, you know, it was a performed reading. So there were two English actors, Alex Jennings and Malcolm Sinclair.
Yeah, I remember I spoke to Alex at the time, ahead of the festival.
And they were wonderful because they played Didi and Gogo in a way that I've never seen before, as the last remnants of the empire, which is a totally different take, which really worked. And then I was allowed to choose my pozzo, so I asked... Oh God, am I gone? Lorcan to do it, so that was great.
Yeah, and were you rabbit then Republicans in terms of Lucky and Pozzo?
No, Lorcan did like the worst kind of gone bean man who's the landlord of every slimy bedsit in the country, and I was a kind of neutral. Probably, yeah. I guess I was more déclassé, but I was Southern. But I didn't like change. I was just me.
I was also kind of astonished to hear that you are the first woman to have performed not just Lucky, but any of those Godot characters.
Yeah. Beckett's estate was very clear about that. There've been a lot of productions that have been stopped when they've tried to cross-gender casting. However, Sean Doran got permission from Edward Beckett for me to play Lucky, and now there is the probability of an actual production which I will play Lucky.
Which you will play, and that will then be historical.
Yeah, that'll be in Sean. Sean would be, you know, going into co-production with a couple of different establishments, and hopefully it'll happen. You know,
have we any idea when that might happen, or is it still in the planning?
Don't know. It's still in conversation, so I think it wouldn't be probably not till 2027.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that certainly sounds very, very exciting. Just one thing before I finish up, just to go back to The Reckoning of Erin Morrigan, I mentioned Jake Doyle. There are others in the film, and there are flashback sequences, but essentially it is a two-hander between yourself and Jake. I didn't know this from watching him on screen. Practically no experience, but boy, did he know how to handle the screen.
No, he's really good. I mean, he's a very committed, very disciplined young actor, and he was just about to go and join drama school, basically. So we just got him around that time. And I've seen him recently, not recently. He came to see The President. That's the last time I saw him. So I'm sure
that was for the pay we're in the gate.
Yeah.
And other theatre plans or film plans in the near future?
A few things, but obviously, personal situation, as which you know about my partner being very ill.
David Heath, actor.
I've had to turn down a few things, but I've finally agreed to do a play, which I start rehearsals in a week's time.
And where and when what?
And it's The Boy in the Abbey Theatre.
Ah, right, yeah. So that is the next time when we will see you on stage. Well, obviously, I wouldn't be alone in asking regards to be passed on to David and Hope.
Thank you.
And regards to both of you. And obviously, this is a difficult time, but we hope that it will come to its best conclusion for both of you in whatever way that happens.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Lovely to speak with you again this evening. That's Alwyn Fuere. And The Reckoning of Erin Morrigan premieres at the Galway Film Fla on Thursday, the 10th of July at 7 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre. There will be a post-screening discussion. Will you be there?
I'll be there.
And herself,
Gabriella
Russell will be there as well, writer and director. You and maybe some others, who knows. Yeah. Tickets and information can be got on the Film Fla website, galwayfilmfla.com. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. 10 years ago, the actor Fra Fee played Romeo in Romeo and Juliet at Dublin's Gate Theatre. Now he's back as Caturian, a writer under interrogation in Martin McDonagh's The Pillar Man. In between then and now, Fra has been busy. He was in Les Miserables, in the film as well as the stage version. He took over the key role of MC from Eddie Redmayne in an acclaimed production of Cabaret. And he starred in Lost Boys and Fairies, the hit TV series about a same-sex couple who wanted to adopt a child. And those are just some of the highlights of the past 10 years. Delighted that Frau Fee joins me on the line right now. At a very interesting time, you're just about, in terms of the Pillow Man, you're just about to go into the theatre and get involved in all the technical sides of things, Frau, sorting out the lights and the sounds and where all of those things are going to happen. So That's right, Sean, yeah. You tell us about what you've finished in terms of the rehearsal. What you feel about Couturian and the Pillow Man at this point in time?
Sure. Well, here, firstly, thanks so much for having me on the show. That was a very lovely introduction. we're at a fairly critical point in the rehearsal process now, where we have finished our rehearsals in the rehearsal room.
Yeah.
And we're about to go into the theatre for the technical rehearsals. So we're sort of leaving the safe space of the rehearsal room where mistakes are made with abandon and there's no such thing as a mistake. And, you know, now we're getting to crunch time because it's sort of, it's very exciting technical rehearsals because you're adding the elemental stuff, lights and sound and costume and everything. And it makes it all a lot more vivid. But you get a sense of a sort of ticking time bomb of, you know, well, the audience are coming soon.
Yeah, well, you're opening on the 9th of July, isn't it?
That's right, with previews from the 4th.
Yeah, so you have a few nights, a few days of technical rehearsals and dress rehearsals and things like that. But I'm wondering about the world of the play of Martin McDonagh. I mean, Martin McDonagh's world is such a crazy type of place anyway. Mm-hmm. But this play in particular is you know, people might think of the Linnan trilogy and plays like that in terms of Martin McDonagh. This is a very different world, a very austere, totalitarian state type of world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm such a huge fan of the Linnan plays. I would have been introduced to them when I was a youngster up in Tyrone, where there's a very vibrant sort of local community dramatic scene. And so I would have been introduced to his plays from then. And I loved the darkness and quite sort of zany characters in them. You know, it's quite surreal comedy, but brilliant. The Pillow Man is all of those things and even sort of pushed even further. You know, it's a more conceptual play. You know, you've got this made up place. It's a totalitarian state in a completely non-specific place. So, you know, our version, we're speaking in our own accent, so it'll feel familiar, but it's not meant to be Ireland. You know, it's meant to be a very specifically imagined place in which there are rules and regulations and a lot of corruption and a lot of injustice. And Couturian, who I'm playing, is a writer of short stories and little fairy tales. And some of his stories are starting to resemble a number of murders that have happened in this particular town. And so he's been interrogated about, you know, the content of his stories. And so for him, his stories are everything. It's about protecting them. He doesn't want them destroyed. He doesn't want them edited. So it's very much about, you know, censorship and the importance of storytelling. I think this is Martin McDonagh's love letter to the art of storytelling, you know, which is his life. That's his art. And it's just it's a thrilling piece of theatre.
Yeah, I love the way you refer to it. He has these little fairy tales, Couturian, the writer. Fairy tales,
yeah, as I say, little fairy tales.
It's one way of describing them. I mean, they're as we've said, McDonagh's world is always a very dark world. Mm-hmm. But these fairy tales are, you know, that these go beyond the Brothers Grimm. They bring us to very dark places.
For sure. I know. I mean, like, kids are lured to dark stories, I think. But I mean, this may be a little bit too macabre for your average 5 or 6 year old. But I think like young teenagers will absolutely love this, you know. And the thing is, they're good. It's like they're really, really dark. But my goodness, the stories are good. Yeah. No one can deny that. They've got very, very satisfying sort of twists and turns. And it's very fun to have that part of the show as well, because some of the stories don't actually exist within the narrative of the play. Then you just have these very special moments where Couturian speaks to the audience directly and tells a story. And we've got a very unbelievably exciting thing happening, where those stories are going to be sort of performed. And yeah, it's a bit of a surprise for the audience. So that part of it's very exciting.
So you're not going to tell me that, and that's perfectly acceptable that you wouldn't. However, I take your point, Fra, that, you know, we don't know where specifically this is. But Katurian has a brother called Michael, who's played played by an Armagh actor. Isn't that right?
That's right, yeah. His name's Ryan Dillon. Yeah.
Ryan Dillon. And then there are two interrogators who are both played by Dubliners. Now, it's
what
very
are we
hard
trying to say?
Well, it's very hard not to point, you know, the two Northern Irish actors and then the two Southerners interrogating them. Do you play into that in any way in the production itself?
I mean, not necessarily. It's proving to be quite useful, just from a sense point of view. For the audience, I think orally it'll be very easy to distinguish these two actors that have Northern Irish voices as being brothers, first of all, and then the two other actors that have more of a sort of Dublin Southern accent as just being from the city, from a place of, of power and position, you know. So it just is really helpful, but it's a very, very happy accident. I was cast ages ago in this, and then Lindsay Turner, our phenomenal director, she didn't go seeking a Northern Irish voice specifically just to find someone to play my brother. She found Ryan, who's he's just perfect for the role, you know. Yeah. But it does help. It does help, I think.
I mentioned in my introduction, you know, a few of the highlights from the past 10 years since doing Romeo and Juliet, playing Romeo in Romeo and Juliet at the Gate. I spoke to your co-star of Lost Boys and Fairies, Sian Daniel Young, at the time. That was a phenomenal series. Tell me about how you, I think you were moved from the minute you read the script.
Absolutely, yeah. I was just, we've been celebrating the show recently because it was just nominated for a BAFTA award, so we were all at the awards, and it felt like such a huge achievement because we were up against some massive big hitters of, you know, the series that have been released in the last few years. But so we're super, super proud of it. Yeah, this tape came through for this story. I got sent the first two episodes and was in bits reading it. I just, the love just poured out of the pages. And then when I, you know, was offered the job, I was given the third episode to read. And again, weeping uncontrollably. There's obviously very sad bits in it, but weeping at the joy, you know, the joy and the love and the familial love, the love that they can have for this child that they just want to invite into their family, you know, to look after the kid. And it just moved me in such a supreme way.
Yeah, one of the things, I mean, it's these two gay men who are going to adopt a child, and see how it works for them. One of the things that struck me about it was that this was just another love story about another set of parents who wanted to adopt a child. The same sex nature of it wasn't that it was sidelined or anything, but it wasn't the main point.
Absolutely. I think there's been plenty of dramas written and very well executed about the gay experience, you know, and they're there for us to tap into and to enjoy and to scrutinize and to, you know, evaluate. This was, as you say, it was a normal story, you know, the sort of typical heterosexual experiences. You meet someone, get married, and then, you know, eventually you want to start a family and have kids. It's the exact same for a gay couple. They want to start a family and to be caretakers and provide a loving life for a child. They just happen to be two men, you know.
Yeah.
And that normalness of that sort of domestic situation, just I found so, so beautiful.
Yeah. No, it was, and it was a phenomenal series, for sure. And then we get to Les Mis. You were playing in Les Mis, I think, on stage. You're in one of the several iterations of the show that has been going on in the West End and all over the place.
For,
you know,
about 50 million years,
somewhere in that region.
I was in there at some stage within that range. Yeah,
but I think you were working on stage in Les Mis. at the point at which the Tom Hooper film came onto the horizon, and everybody in the cast was auditioning for it. Mm. That, what kind of atmosphere did that create?
I mean, thinking back, I think we were all just quite excited, and you know, we couldn't really believe that the movie musical was happening. There was just like news in the grapevine, I guess, and then all of a sudden we were all being brought in to audition for one of the many, many, many roles, of course, that are in the movie, you know, because Les Mis is such an epic story. So you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cast members. I guess we were all given the opportunity because we all knew that the show and could sing, because I guess, you know, the main thing was this ensemble that consisted of hundreds and hundreds of people had to be able to sing. And so I think I was just the right age at the right time when it was being made and to be considered for a student. And yeah, I got cast as Kofarak in the movie, and it was my first time on a movie set. It was my first introduction to acting on screen, and a perfect introduction, in fact, because I was utilising some of the skills that I was a lot more familiar with.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman and Russell Crowe, of course, the Jean Valjean and Javert characters within that. And the singing was live on set, as famously in that 2012 film adaptation. Yeah. So was music was always there. You mentioned the amateur dramatic movements and watching a lot of that growing up, and I think your dad was involved in that side of things. You studied music initially, and I'm coming to cabaret and all of this, but was music always the direction before acting, or how? What was the order of play there?
Not necessarily, Sean. I mean, I think at a young age, I just loved lots of different things. You know, I was really into my music. I was really discovering my singing voice and taking that quite seriously. But then I would be doing, you know, these shows with my local theatre groups at the same time. You know, I did drama and music at school. Hmm. I think I chose to do music at university because I had an idea of what I thought drama school would be. And this is, of course, based on watching things like Fame. You know, like that's sort of like my point of reference. And I thought to myself, oh, that looks quite intense. So maybe I'll just go into university, study music, only have a few hours of lectures a week, and I can actually, you know, have the freedom to just discover who I am and do my own thing. And so after 3 years of studying music, I then did musical theatre at the Royal Academy of Music, which I felt was a sort of a nice meeting of my interests, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And after just doing musicals for the first few years of my career, I sought out to diversify and do plays. So I feel very lucky to be able to be branching out into different things.
Yeah, and I should mention that one of the plays that you've done in the meantime as well, between the two appearances at the gate, was Jez Butterworth's play with Sam Mendes, The Ferryman, and an award-winning performance for you in that. But I'll finish up by, I'll come back to Kachurian and The Pillow Man in a second, but I'll finish up with Eddie Redmayne and how he contacted you when you heard you were taking over the role of MC in that wonderful production, which Jessie Buckley was in, I think, originally. She was, I think, probably gone by the time you were playing MC, was she?
So Jessie performed the role of Sally Bowles opposite Eddie's MC. Hmm. And I think that they opened the show to massive acclaim, and you could not get a ticket for love nor money. It was just such the hottest ticket in town. And after about 3 months, I think that was their run, I got a very, very out of the blue offer to take over the role from Eddie, from Rebecca Frecknell, who's the director of that amazing production. And of course, myself and Eddie go back to the Les Mis movie days, it's like maybe 13 years ago with that film. And I just got a text from him saying, I hear you're going to be emceeing. And it was a lovely passing of the baton, because of course, whenever I was rehearsing, he was still finishing off his run. So he was able to give me some practical tips on the sort of costumes, logistics and things like that. And I mean, his performance was just absolutely out of this world. And I I knew I wouldn't be able to do anything like what he was doing, but you know, I was just given the freedom to put my own spin on it, I suppose. But he was very, very supportive and very kind.
Yeah, I'm sure he would be the first person to say to you to do just that. Don't do me, do yourself. Mm-hmm. You'll do yourself better than anybody else can do.
Absolutely.
So the only remaining question then is, have you asked Martin McDonagh to write a song for Couturian yet? Seems a shame that we don't get a little bit of a number from you.
I know, God, and I know no singing in this one. I mean, there's plenty of talking, like, so I think my voice is happy to have a break from the singing. Plenty of storytelling, but it might be nice to maybe set one of those stories to music. Maybe I'll do it myself for the crack.
I feel a new film coming on already. Listen, Fra, lovely to speak with you this evening. Best of luck with this period now as you head into the theatre and the technical rehearsals and the dress rehearsals and all of that. Hope it goes well for you, and all the best for the run.
Thanks a million, Sean.
That's Fra Fee, who plays Couturian in The Pillow Man by Martin McDonagh. Previews at the Gate Theatre from the 4th of July, opens on the 9th, runs through until the 7th of September. Full details on gatetheatre.ie. After a decade living and creating music in Australia, Áine Tyrrell returns to Ireland, bringing with her her powerful story of survival, resilience and reconnection. From her nomadic life on a 1966 bus in the outback with her children to her artistic rebirth and the influence of her late father, troubadour Sean Tyrrell. Áine has always spoken candidly about her journey through domestic abuse, activism and the healing power of music ahead of her homecoming performance at the wonderfully named Hibernical Festival in Dublin. She's with me in studio this evening. I'm going to start straight away with the new single, Singing Our Way Home.
If I had a poem, I could draw to the surface all of this yearning around and between. That could breathe this canyon of misunderstanding of the lands we are held in. If I had the stories of the old ones before me, whose lands I feel faint. Sing loudly, then I feel home, then I be home. We're all walking home, singing our way home. If I had the rhythm of the sun, moon and mountains, of the stars and my changa, from the tongues of our ancients. If I had the knowing in my hips, I keep moving that has always been seeding. If I had a lesson that could offer protection, both medicine and weapon, to clear the path we are walking, singing our way home.
Áine Tuirrell live in studio this evening on Arena with her single Singing Our Way Back Home. Áine will be part, as I said, of the Hibernical Festival at Orla House in Rathfarnham, I believe that is, July the 4th through until the 6th. And the new single is out right now. Delighted that Áine is with me in studio this evening. As I listen to that, Áine, it really strikes me, you sound so content that you really have found your way back home through that song. So it's been it hasn't been an easy journey back home in many ways, metaphorically and literally.
Definitely. Yeah, it's been a big journey being over there. And
you were in Australia.
Yeah, and being able to come back, I suppose. I wrote a lyric on the new album a good few years ago that was like, I want to sail back in my own ship in my own steam, you know, and there was a time where I could have come back, but I felt like I would have been a victim of a story of what happened to us over there, you know, and to be able to come back now, you know, feeling empowered and strong in myself. And
I know you had a long interview, I was listening to it today, a long interview that you gave to Brendan O'Connor a few years back about your time in Australia and the domestic abuse that you suffered at that time and survived at that time. What role did music play? I mean, when I hear that song, I can hear loads of things, roles played. But for you, what role did music play in that journey?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'd lost myself for many years. And so coming back to myself was coming back to music, you know, and really, you know, starting off playing music again in lands that weren't my own, knowing nobody, you know, it was really like it was for me, you know, that's why what it was for. And it just, you know, it's amazing that a decade later I'm doing it full time. And, you know, it is my life, you know, but it always was. But that's what happens with, you know, abuse and violence is you lose some of yourself there, and it's a kind of a reclaiming to get it back.
And that moment, you know, there must have been a first moment when you took up the guitar again, or you sat at the keyboard. I presume it was a guitar. You have two guitars and a banjo in with you this evening, so I presume it was some kind of stringed instrument. That first moment when you took it up and even, you know, strumming a few chords and then trying to sing. That can't have been the easiest moment in your life, or was it?
No, it was, because for me, I kind of was like with my kids, I was like, well, I can't keep telling them that they can, you know, do anything they want and be what they want to be if I'm not actually doing that myself, you know, if I'm not following my dreams and what I'm, you know, born to do in a way. And so it was easy for them, probably not easy for me at the start, you know, whereas now, you know, it is, you know, like breathing and eating. And you know, art is such a huge part of my life.
And again, it really struck me when you were singing Our Way Back Home, that guitar. I'd asked you about it before, because you were doing the sound check before the programme tonight, and I saw the four tuning knobs. And, oh, that's a bass guitar. No, it's not. It's a four-string tenor guitar.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sound. Where did you come across that instrument? I hadn't heard of the tenor guitar before.
My dad collected all sorts of mad.
Your dad, Sean Tyrrell, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Famously, he's like four-string mandocello and all of those. So we always had four-string instruments around the house. So picking up a six-string was actually quite radical.
You were a rebel.
That's it.
And yeah. And was that his guitar? Or?
Yeah, that's his. Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
That connection must be quite special as well, to be playing his instrument.
Yeah, and keeping that, you know, I suppose the lineage and the legacy alive. It, you know, he carved an incredible path of his own. So, and he taught us all to do that. And you know, with the music, it's been, you know, there are different paths you can take, and especially actually living over there. In so-called Australia, it's like it, you know, they try to keep you into little boxes. So like in the music, you know, you're Irish, therefore you're supposed to sound like the Coors or you know,
whatever box they want to put you in.
Yeah, and you know, that's what's actually beautiful about Hibernical as well. This coming weekend is it's just such a diverse lineup of what contemporary Irish music is.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the names that are on it. Lisa Hannigan is in there.
Yeah,
Wallace Bird is in there. You know,
and just fabulous, like that version of, and really, Dad, I could have fallen into the trap of playing all of that over there and had a much easier path than I've had. But that's not what he taught us. You know?
You're going to sing one of his songs for us ever this evening. His version of Rising of the Moon. Explain a little bit of that feeling when you're taking a song that you've heard your father sing, and obviously it has to become your song as well. What's that process?
Yeah, well, that song was beautiful because I had got asked to sing it for the Irish Australian Song Library because it was the last song. It was one of the songs that was sung on the last ship that went into Fremantle, a convict ship that was all Irish political prisoners. And they kept record and they sang that song on board the ship.
Wow.
So when I sang it sort of first for that, I really got to know the lyrics and the song in a different way than hearing my dad sing it, and kind of the connection with those lands. And and it just, every time I sing it, was a song that a lot of people could feel into.
It adds a new dimension to it. I'll let you go back over to the performance, Mike. And I'll just remind people that Hibernicle Festival, Orla House in Rathfarnham, July the 4th through until the 6th. And Singing Your Way Back Home, the new single, is out right now. So this is a version of Rising of the Moon by Sean and Anne Tyrrell then. Can I say that with an Australian element to it?
Well, the original is, John Keegan Casey, and then Pádraig Stevens and Siobhan Higgins had rewrote the lyrics, and Dad brought that out on his album. So yeah, so, and there's a bit of Onya in there as well.
Stand up and be counted. What a wonderful lyric that is. And it's something I think you've done through your telling us your story about domestic abuse and in your many forms of activism. Anya, thanks so much for sharing that song with us this evening. And just to remind you, hibernicle.ie will give you all of the details. Pillow Queens, Lisa Hannigan, Ye Vagabonds, Wallace Bird, Jape, Alva Reddy, Gráinne Hunt and Anya Tyrrell, who we've just heard. And a special headliner to be announced. That's not all.
I think it already is. Villagers.
Oh, Villagers. Yeah, it has been announced at this point. Okay, well, that makes it even more worthwhile. That is our lot for this evening. Can I tell you that tomorrow night we will be speaking to Fiona Shaw about her latest film, which is called Hot Milk. Really looking forward to hearing her tell us about that. But that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.